February 15th, 2013. Members present in the room, including Representative Strachan, Stormy, Justice Group, and myself, Judge Barnholz, with our funding and quorum to conduct business. Based on our recordings, the virtual meeting is open to any or other member. But that brings for joining us today. If you haven't done, it's a great time to have some cell phones for the duration of the meeting. We have three items on our agenda today. The cost of health care, district agency affirmation, presentation, but the cost of children's test, and the cost of child abuse neglect in the state of Alaska, and an impact hearing on House Bill 259. The Justice Committee has previously considered House Bill 4003 in the fourth special session of 2021. I was going to consider you on that. Each up is a brief presentation of health care costs by the State of Alaska and Chief Policy Analyst for the Office of Budget and Budget to Relying on Solutions. Thank you, Chair Reynolds. Good morning, members of the House Committee. Through some discussions with the chair, I'm here to talk about how much we spend on health care in the state budget. There have been many studies over the years when you look at the cost of health care in Alaska. The cost in turn is broken down by payer, by beneficiary, and this is a general level, just you have health care plans for what we can see. Many of you have seen this graph in your subcommittee process. We call it the SWOOP graph because all of the agency budgets, each year I've compared to the relative scale of the different departments. And I don't know if you're here, of course, because you've all seen this, but on the actual, this is a call out the portion of the budget that's spent on healthcare directly or indirectly. You can see that healthcare is actually the single biggest expenditure. It depends even the Department of Education. And of course, the Department of Health, because the Medicaid program is removed. You can also see that the Department of Family and Community Services is now smaller than it would be. Here's just another look at healthcare spending as a portion of total agency operations. You can see, of course, the Department of Health makes up 20% of the agency operating budget. Of course, most of that's the Medicaid program. And the Department of Corrections and the Department of Family and Community Services make up another 4%. This graph excludes some indirect expenditures on healthcare, like retiree healthcare contributions, K-12 enrollment healthcare, and the University of Legislature reports and the NHS budgets. Of the healthcare spending in the state budget by fund source over time. And you can see here in blue are the unrestricted general funds, in orange designated general funds, gray is other, and the large bold section is federal funding. And if there's not federal funding, it's almost entirely the federal share of the Medicaid budget. And you can see over time that it's been largely flat in terms of the state funds, the new health and blue and orange sections. And the federal funding, of course, has grown over time, and most of that was in the Medicaid expansion. And here is the last slide, and this just shows the year-to-year share of health spending, which in the prior slide was the blue bar, And this is broken down by department category. So in the bottom of the blue section is the part of collections that Skyline's paid for being made elsewhere. That orange, of course, just starts in FY23, that's the new Department of Building and Resources, which includes API, the Pioneer Homes, and the Visual Design Justice, healthcare for those huge and busy. The gray bar is the Department of Health, which is mostly the Medicaid program, but also people have health using. And the family section is employee healthcare across all departments. You can see the blue line shows the percent of each of our business operations spent on healthcare, and it's been relatively flat between a quarter to almost 3%. I made sure all the slides are prepared for the committee today, so if there are follow-up questions or requests for additional information, I'm happy to provide that.
Any additional points that on a previous slide discussed briefly about the spike in TGF? This one here, by the way.
Sure, thank you. Here's the term towards under shock. That actually is the last reinsurance program. It is financed and budgeted in some kind of unusual ways. And in FY21, it's reflected as a large increase in DGF due to the timing of how the federal appropriation for the reinsurance program ends up passing through the budget of the federal fiscal year.
Stores presidency analyzed the challenge stress state by organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect. Some of our most valuable resources, the literally our future, and last is prosperity depends on our ability to improve the well-being of families in the next generation. Unfortunately, Alaska has one of the highest rates of child abuse and neglect per capita in the nation. Today, I've been asked to disclose the cost of child abuse and neglect. In order to do that, it's important to set the context. Child abuse and neglect is a complex issue. It's not like polio where we created a vaccine and then immunize anyone. There's not one cause nor one solution. We also have to look at parents. Parents want their children to thrive and never intend to abuse or neglect them. But when they don't have the knowledge, skills, supports, or resources, it puts strain on them that can lead to child abuse and neglect. And you've got to make this. Life is not going to last at that. When a family experiences stress or trauma, like food insecurity, domestic violence, child care, limited access to physical or mental health services, or having to work two jobs, it puts tension on that bad. And without the knowledge, support, resources, or skills, that aging stays. When you have more stretchers, and you operate with an elastic band, you're losing it just so far. When it snaps, that's when child abuse and neglect occurs. Our work at the Children's Trust is to provide children, families, and the community that knowledge, skills, supports, and resources to lessen that tension, which reduces the risk of child abuse and neglect from occurring. The question we continually ask our communities or ourselves are, how will our children be? How will this graph tell 2021, Alaska was ranked 43rd out of 50 states for overall cattle well-being. At Tinskill, which is a national program at the IUPC Foundation that provides these rankings based on a series of key indicators. And as you can see from this chart, we're either in the bottom half or more often actually the bottom third. And picked out the county's four core areas: education, family and community, economic well-being, and health. This slide shows how Alaska was ranked in each of these areas compared to other states. Again, not faring so well. But there is one data point that sums up how well the children and youth are doing, or more importantly, how they're struggling. Pre-COVID, spanning just over 10 years' time, the rate of Alaska high school students who applied to suicide attempts in the past year increased by over 30% for males and nearly 70% for females. We are literally on the edge, looking over, and thinking the only thing an absolutely left is to get that final step. No one goes from 0 to 60. There is a lot that's happening before it. This really captures how our children and youth are doing today. So let's talk about economic impact of child abuse and neglect. In 2020, the Children's Trust released an economic impact of child abuse and neglect report. Noah Clark was our lead researcher. The report is included in the packet. The costs are based on 2019 OCS numbers with over 3,100 substantial cases of child maltreatment. When the cost of child abuse and neglect is discussed, usually individuals move on to short term lens, looking at whether it costs just investigate or the judicial class. Leaving out the damage that affects the victims and can last a lifetime. This affects not only the health and quality of life of the individual, but impose costs on society. Two methods of quantifying the lifetime cost of child abuse and neglect were used. First, the human problem. Rather than individuals left based on their lifetime earnings potential, it costs a single victim for their lifetime over $300,000, or a total cost of $710 million for all victims in 2018. The second is value burst of physical life, quality adjusted life years, and it includes a dollar value that quantifies the quality and quality of life. It costs a single victim for their lifetime nearly $970,000, or a total cost of $2.3 billion for all victims in 2019. Let's break it down even further. Healthcare. Victims of child abuse and neglect experience more healthcare complications than their general population. It costs over $80,000 per victim, which equates to just over $200 million for the victims of 2019. Losses. Abuse or neglect of child is correlated with increased earnings power over the course of a lifetime. So adjusting for inflation is estimated that between the ages of 18 and 64, victims of maltreatment earn nearly 7,000 less than their peers each year, totaling nearly 165,000 over their lifetime. Criminal justice. Children experience abuse and neglect will more likely be arrested in terms of crimes, both as juveniles and adults. Costs Alaska over $12,000 per victim and nearly $30 million in total. Special education. Victims often experience delays in their education programs, requiring special education services more frequently. It costs Alaska nearly $2,000 per victim and over $50 million in total. Child welfare. It costs Alaska nearly $15,000 per victim and over $35 million in total. And then the quality of life. Intangible like emotional damage, the quality of life are difficult to measure. But to get into your contract and retirement use cases over $800,000, and reduce quality of life for a total of $1.96 billion. There's other ways also to look at the cost of time use of life. We can also examine it through another lens to cost of trial. Average all experiences, many of you heard me talk about cases, on negative childhood experiences that can lead to poor health, mental health, physical health, and social economic status in adulthood. After collecting Alaska-specific census data, the Alaska Mental Health Board released information showing the price of children per state. It's important to note that of the 10 cases examined in the study, 5 were types of child abuse and neglect. This reminder for health and health agencies caused much more consequences. Users dislike the neural development of brain development of a child that then can lead to that social, emotional, and cognitive impairment, which then leads to adaptive high-risk behaviors like smoking, potentially using substances, things of that nature that then leads to disease, disability, and social problems like homelessness, being part of the correctional system, lung disease, heart disease, and so forth, and then leads to early death. Let's look at the cost. Here, 100% of Medicaid enrollment in Alaska can be linked back to users, so these are individuals. 22,000 Alaskans rely on Medicaid due to ages at an estimated cost of $360 million. So again, these are individuals that are prepared to travel when the case is smaller. 10% of Alaskan smokers likely smoke due to ACEs, and it is one of those coping mechanisms. Each year, 37,000 Alaskans with ACEs smoke, costs us around $190 million. You get the idea. Diabetes costs us about $110 million. Obesity, and these are the disabilities and disease that we're talking about, $31 million. And then binge drinking. 75. So talking about just what the impact is on health, we need to talk about the solutions. So what can we do as a state to improve the lives of our current families while obtaining a sustainable budget that reduces costs? It's important to recognize that a sustainable budget is not achieved in 1 or 2 years. We recognize that. It requires upfront investments in achieving the current methodologies of how we ensure children, youth, families, and communities gain that knowledge, skills, supports, and resources to thrive. Because they thrive, the risk of child abuse and neglect is greatly reduced, and many of our issues greater than state are reduced, resulting in major savings. So how do we do this? First, recommendations look at return on investment. To better understand why Alaska continues to rank so poorly, 43rd again, in our capital P, compared to other states, it is important to examine how Alaska invests current resources towards children. So in 2020, it's always has released the first ever children's budget for Alaska, a fiscal mapping project. The copy is in the back. There are copies if you still need them in the back. The lead researcher was Jonathan Kim, a healthcare consultant. All budget components and capital projects for the last decade were categorized as either in or out of the children's budget. To be in, the line item must correctly support children, youth, and families based on their status as a child, a youth, or family. Items that generally benefit society as a whole without regard to the studies do not qualify. Examples are most education expenditures, fishery management, and even the permanent fund period does not count towards children's budget. In FY20, Alaska dedicated 30% of its spending to children and families. We can say with confidence the 2021 and 2022 budget will either be the same or lower. What are some key findings? Total children's budget is nearly 13%, 400 million smaller than investing enforcement by 140. And capital is down 195% compared to FRA 11 and 14. So when we start, a great example of how return on investment is really confident in the producer. The plan for 20 years laid the foundation for their success. The plan is establishing growth and development. It prevents the achievement gap, improves health outcomes, boosts lifelong earnings, and provides the highest rate of economic return. Early childhood education, birth to age 5, significantly impacts the rest of child education. For every dollar we invest in early childhood, there is a $7 to $13 return on investment.
Here we move on back to my question on non-departmental operating budget. Can you just put a minor point on that with the non-departmental operating budget?
Absolutely. If you have the frame or the page to make sure I don't give you any info, it is the portion that flows to the statewide items to keep retirement system payments, debt service, fund transfers, and fund capitalization to the departments.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yes, I believe the purple way it's been rolled through the chair. Actually, I'm sorry, thank you. Sorry for missing that again. Yes, a lot of this is so capital use related to the hard materials, capital things that we use, especially school buildings, things of that nature. There are other capitals in terms of just buying equipment, computers, and so forth. So things of that nature, and as we know, capital budgets vary from year to year, so it's really hard to put tangible items in the books.
The challenge budget tied to the analysis that was done at FRA 11 for FRA 14 during some of the highest capital contributors that we've had in the capital budget is now a fraction of what it was when the overall prices peaked. Are there any other questions on this topic?
Just talk about that return on investment. So Dan Seckman, the Nobel Prize winning American economist, created the Heckman curve, which shows that the highest rate of economic returns comes from the earliest investment in children, illustrating an adult reality that society invests far too much in harbor, or I should say later development, when it is too often too late to provide great value. One last early childhood environmental scan that was conducted by the All-Life and Pediatric Partnership, H&B2, in 2020, Alaska spends less than 1% of its general fund directly on early childhood investment. The thing that derives the greatest return on investment, or one of the greatest, we put the least in. Yet we see a different trend when we look at one of the investments that has little to no return on investment. Corrections. The department's general fund budget, excluding SB 55 included, increased by about 80 million, 28% between FY 13 and FY 23, as currently proposed. It is going back into this budget. We have seen that our investment in children going down, and yet the tertiary effect is where we're paying our money, which gives us little to no return on that investment. And if we did that with our permanent buying account, we know we would be having a different conversation. Next is primary prevention. It has taken us decades to get where we are today. This did not happen overnight. It will take several years to change the trends, but we continue to only feed the line. History shows our numbers in this line will increase, and costs will continue to rise. We need to feed the line as well as shorten the line, and that's where we're getting the cost savings. To achieve this, we need to train our methodology by investing in primary prevention. We need to go so fast when we stop the place of humanity. Primary prevention is the same methodology we use for roads. We do not allow growth to deteriorate to the point of being unemployable. We continue to take preventative measures to ensure the longevity and reduce the negative impact on loan rates. So here are some examples. Some point of entry developing that point of entry to access various supports and resources the state provides to covered families. It will reduce the risk of it being frustrating applications and our families are doing their best to fulfill the world need by implementing some form of broad-based, categorical eligibility for all basic need programs. By establishing a single point of entry, families can enter any program or door and be screened for eligibility across all the programs. Being able to fill out one application reduces the administrative cost and thus all reduces barriers to families and helps address the core issue of limiting families' access to the knowledge, skills, support, and resources they need. Poverty. Strengthening and safety net increases economic mobility and stability. When a family has economic stability, it reduces the tension and the rubber band that we were talking about, lessening that risk in many of the social, behavioral, and physical ills that are coming our state. And growth per share in Alaska is below the national rate of poverty. In 2018, 14% of Alaskan children lived at or below 100% of U.S. poverty level. For family four, it was just under 32,000. Currently, this year, it's nearly 35 at poverty level. Also, families begin having children when they earn the least amount of income in their adult life, which can put great strain on the family. Child abuse and neglect occurs most often during the first few years of a child's life. Nearly 50% of Alaska's child abuse and neglect cases are under the age of 5. And the most common type of abuse is neglect, which is strongly associated with poverty. Next, the uninsured rate of children. Poverty prevention is ensuring all Alaska children have primary coverage. Last month, the highest rate of uninsured children at 9.4%, over 18,000, and it's estimated 10,000 of those children were eligible for denied Medicare or Medicaid. When children are uninsured, they are more likely to have unmet health needs that can lead to greater costs in education, health, and economic well-being. And research shows that children with insurance experience higher educational attainment and other positive long-term outcomes. Of course, there is a cost, and we just had a presentation, Medicaid comes with the cost. That's important to note that federal government covers 90% of all expenses for children and 100% of all expenses on Alaska Native children. And we know that one of the least users under Medicaid are going to cost when we break it down. Even though it will be a cost, it's a minor cost in compared to what adults have to use due to the fact that they are using it for preventative versus tertiary coverage. So how does this reduce the cost? First, it could be the efficient addition of funding mental health counselors for school nurses in schools. This is really key, especially as we were talking about the mental health challenges, which has led to the suicide rate. Secondly, it promotes developmental screening. Alaska overall is very well with 77% of 3-year-olds having received the developmental screening, but there is room for improvement. Developmental screenings allow issues to be identified sooner, lessening the negative impact like requiring special education services. Alaska certified establishes a task force to achieve around 90%. And if you talk about the quality of work for many school administrators, one of the highest rising costs other than the teachers is the need of special education. And thirdly, it also strengthens family financial stability and again going back to poverty. Another example is family planning. So there's 18,000 children that are uninsured, but that 10,000 are eligible for Medicaid or denied Medicaid.
So, in order to be
get into the details, hospitals don't have a good job of course. They want to ensure that they get paid through so that we have insurance. They want to know that they get paid three times. So they do an analysis and then they help families get into. But breaking up the arm is right. But a lot of it is on the preventative side, as well as making sure that there is certain things that you can test, because we are well tracking here, because a lot of people, you can catch things. That's the idea of getting the kids by connected, as well as expand our ability as a state to be looking at other ways of funding school counselors and nurses and things of that nature.
And healthcare costs are very high in the scale of Scott and Sarah. Insurance all the way from reducing poverty as well for our families, which I think is really important. Before the bottom of the top, this representative approach by USAP 12369. Are there any additional questions from this topic?
Thank you, Mr. Scott, I was wondering when you talk about the second point of entry, can you give me an idea of what some of the precedents make sure you do that?
Absolutely. Again, I apologize for that. Yes, we went to the chat to represent our story. Hopefully using technology. Technology is great. I recognize the Department of Health Services, which knows that some struggles with that. But other states are using technology that when individuals put in, they put that information to one central, they provide the basics, and that will help them determine they want to be eligible for it. So, going for food stamps, those who need the SAS and help. Staff will do this. We talk to the department, but it's not always consistent in order to get across the programs. They may assess them also for already eligible for Medicaid, already eligible for housing, whatever they need to get out of poverty. And again, we hear the story when you get somebody out of poverty with these assistance, they last down for life. They then get the supports they need and then drop off. They are continuing to be successful. So it's that central risk system. And even if they're eligible, because unfortunately we can't sway from federal requirement, there are sometimes additional questions and/or ways that we have to move on that different program to program. And then they just have to fill those out. But there's a way of continuing eligibility. Some people don't become overwhelmed by the paperwork, or they are be discouraged by the paperwork.
So you suggesting another portal that social services programs, or are you suggesting that as partnerships, this portal be for the department that key partners?
That's a great question. There would need to be a team to put together to figure out what's best and how to set that up.
And I think that this is an important part of what is that discussion is taking place in the Legend and the Health and Social Services Committee. You know, that our website is very interested in ensuring that, you know, there's sort of streamlined, easy, application process that everyone is working towards getting, you know, an online application. The process is not fully there yet. And we, you know, it's an advisory time for anything. You know, low-income people are also going to have computers at their homes, and most of us in these days can't expect that we should be able to move to these kinds of, you know, things on our phones these days. And so moving towards an edit would be very helpful in reducing the barriers to getting access to services. But that would require a pretty significant effort, I think, to be referenced by smart to make me determine across department collaboration as well as making it a capital investment in the network. But if we did do that, we could potentially reduce child poverty and scale lifestyle as Mr. Sharks mentioned earlier, 50% of all families in Alaska scale lifestyle is actually neglect and it's going to be associated with poverty. So there are good solutions, but it's that would require a lot of work.
Right. In terms of predictions in the chair. It's any type of chance this impact.
Thank you.
My example is family planning. And I recognize this topic can be controversial. And when we talk about family planning, it does not include abortion. The general trust recognizes parents or their children. students first, the most important teachers, and mentors. They know what is best for them. However, some parents don't have the knowledge, skills, supports, or resources to have the conversation teens need, young adults need, in order to keep productive health. I'm happy to share from 2009 to 2018, we have seen a 58% decline in teen births. However, even with this progress, Alaska teen birth rates are consistently higher than the national rates. But why is this important to the prevention journey from adult? Researchers found that unintended pregnancy is an important risk factor in predicting and addressing child maltreatment. Births that result from unintended precocious space pregnancies are associated with adverse maternal and child health outcomes, adverse maternal mental health, increased risk of physical violence during pregnancy, and increased risk of child abuse and neglect, to name a few. Programs and policies that support intended pregnancies can serve as a powerful protective factor to prevent child maltreatment and help families build safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments. Approximately 40% of all births in Alaska are paid by Medicaid. Ways to further reduce unintended and precocious-based pregnancies include implementation of comprehensive human development classes. Children as soon as they start school begin to learn about their body, both the physical and mental aspects. Children and youth need to understand how their body develops inside and out so they can begin to develop the skills to better manage the changes they will experience and learn about healthy relationships. And secondly, we need to increase voluntary access to long-acting reversible contraception. Reinvent child welfare. The next solution is reinventing it. Currently, the main role of most cases is investigating allegations of child abuse and neglect and take action. Most of our CS resources is dedicated to intervening after an issue arises. Imagine if we provided knowledge, skills, supports, and resources to families before child abuse leads to the level requiring OCS intervention. Over 85% of all reports make OCS were screened out. However, research shows that the red line of learning and reporting rate increases after each report, and a third or fifth report, most families are found screened in. With over 75% of the substantial increases occurring due to neglect, which is the failure of a parent or caregiver to provide proper care, including providing adequate shelter, clothing, food, medical care, supervision, education. Imagine if these families were provided supports after their initial report. If the issue that the cause of neglect was addressed prior to our CS intervention, Alaska could save hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. From an annual study that we commissioned in 2015, children who were reported to OCS more than once as victims of maltreatment account for more than two-thirds of OCS investigations. The diagram shows that from 2005 to 2013, OCS investigated over 36,000 reports of maltreatment involving over 19,000 individual children. About 40% of those children were the subject of more than one investigation, but they account for nearly 70% of the investigations. It is clear that reducing repeat maltreatment would not only better protect children, but could also substantially reduce OCS's caseload.
There's a high number of reports that don't result in further action.
upstairs for trying to address that. And there's legal rules, but if we actually put real energy towards this, again, it's really next step and giving that off-ramp with great support. Again, that's primary prevention and reduces that cost. And just to add to that, this kind of conversation I had with OCS leadership, all of them, they're hard for about prevention, but if you look at dedicated positions towards primary prevention, they have two staff that are under the staff members. And then other people do a little bit on the side, but really they only have two positions dedicated. And of course, there's other divisions within, but we are not doing that as much of attention as we are being expanded again. Return on investment in the upstream effect.
Okay. Thank you. Often the chair will call the council if 50% of the cases being neglected. In my mind, they go to our opioid epidemic and the spine control unit of 8 cases. I am wondering if you can give me a little bit more background about within that 75%. If there is any knowledge of the reason for the referral.
So, I think the chair's representative story. So, we know over 80% of cannabis neglect cases involve substance, and the majority of substance is alcohol. Opioid has had an impact, if we look at the history, it is definitely alcohol. And then, we would need to also then go through and look at the history of level of treatment that is available or not available. I think for that interesting, that is usually primary. In many of these families, going back to our patients, a lot of those parents, again, they want their kids to be safe. They are not purposely doing this, but they're dealing with their own trauma. And unfortunately, because of our systems, people don't have health care, or the services are available, or the stigma or the combination, many of them don't seek treatment and they utilize self-medication, which is usually alcohol. Not much that leads them on this path. And that's why we need those bigger costs, like we were talking about on the trauma side.
Thank you.
And we did hear from McKinsey Research last week about that economic cost of substance misuse and that total cost to Alliance was $3.45 billion in the last year. Well, they have a new work in Germany, so they want to use one of the major costs.
Next motion is tribal compacting. Investing in indigenous peoples will not alone solve all the challenges they face, but it will be key to addressing the disparities. Tribal compacting is returning the power to the people, as the saying goes, nothing about me without me. Compacting promotes indigenous values and customs, promotes greater community involvement, and helps create the protective factors families and communities need to address the traumas and build resilience. The last switch I'm going to share is strengthening data collection and management. In today's presentation, data needs to be one of the key drivers helping these coming out best to invest class of resources to ensure our children can thrive. Without data, we are only having in climate assumptions, we are basically driving blind. Data will help detect issues sooner, which leads to cost savings. So recommendations in this area would be conducting the youth risk behavioral system surveys in middle school and not just high school to identify emerging risky behaviors and trends while there's still time to influence those behaviors before children become adults. Currently, we only do high school. And second, data collection should be opt-out instead of opt-in to provide for a broader and deeper assessment of risky behaviors among the likes of youth. business users without data. Thank you for this opportunity. And if there's any further questions, please ask. But otherwise, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. If you talked about risk being a survey, opt-in versus opt-out, that's a sticky wicket. So I guess I disagree with the I understand the concept, but I disagree with the premise. And we have to have a different approach to where people are willing to opt in rather than setting it up in the way you are. If I'm going to do an ice cream cone, then I guess we do like a banana ice cream cone. The odds are you say yes, or for the first two, the ice cream, it's like the salty ice cream. And I think that's a challenge we have to overcome.
So that's why I really appreciate that. And when you're talking about bringing out communities, one of the key things I think in the church stress support is not convening time decisions. You just bring it up. I do think that it is really important that we don't just do the way you're being metric. And data management isn't just about collecting data, it's about also educating people about the data to share. Many times, again, because of the need for policy, because of lack of desire or need for collecting equity, or state organizations, possibly don't have the capacity to release it and educate people, and even get times to analyze it and get the reports out. So it's more than just the opt-in and opt-out. And I think that we're doing things like that and helping our community members from the ground all the way up to leadership. On the opt-in and opt-out, we're even doing some of the people who hopefully will just not be using, but I think it is those communications.
Suggestions for improving these numbers and supporting families better. I was just wondering if you if there was a problem that you felt we should start on and focus first, what the best return on investment, just some recommendations.
Sure. Thank you very much. Just for people now, maybe you missed all the recommendations plus more are in your packet. These are from the Kids Club report and the children's budget report provide. So much of what I've shared today is nothing new that I've developed. So if I really thought about return on investment, I think I would be when it's reported, it's really going to be looking at from a job look. There is some current opportunities for you as legislators that have been reported before you. There is some discussion around the rating and ticket. There's another opportunity for you to invest that early and change that 1% and move it up with a better return. There's also a bit of one recall health for youth. When we just saw this number of this was and none of these are used in cure, but it's a really good start and it's something you could do in a matter of 3 months that would have an impact. But lastly, what I think it also needs to be a cultural and a change is you as a legislator, because when you're speaking to the departments and your commissioners, you all have amazing influence. And speaking to them about what are you doing for primary prevention, asking them to go back and look at what are you implementing primary, and if not, what changes will be needed. Let's not just rely on myself and the children's health, we have amazing people in those departments that actually know this information better than I and have the solutions. And one of those people is, and hopefully many of you have seen it, is Dr. Doug Bush in his last longevity study that really looked at these issues. And I've used some of his data and his comment throughout this presentation and much of the work that we do.
Thank you. Presentation to Mr. Frozen. I really appreciate it. I think the general of this community is very interested in using cross drivers, and there are multiple sort of cross drivers related to general music that maybe not, we have probably we're spreading here, and probably does have long term impacts on the children and families that are impacted by general music. Does that make me more cross?
was referencing, and this is a problem that we can get upstream and we can provide that conversion power with families early on before children were removed, who would achieve a very laudable goal of keeping families together while reducing harm to children and saving the state a lot of money. And that's sort of how we scenario that I think we would all like to see advanced. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So, next up, we're going to get into that brief around House Bill 1059, the major structure split of the Senate Health and Family Drive, Center for Chemical Education. I'm going to go ahead and pass the battle over to both the Ranking Committee Member, Representative Boston, who's going to chair the rest of the meeting today. And with that, I'm going to take a brief break.
In the House Ways and Means Committee, and today is the 15th day of February, and it is about 12 p.m. Before us, the House Bill 259, and before the Representative Chair's panel begins the presentation, I'd like to take note that online now for questions is Carter Bell, Jody Sullivan, Counties of the Division of Legislative Finance. And we'll begin by hearing the Chair's Balance's presentation. And then we will move to take some questions, I'm sure, for a moment and then testify. So, Chair's Balance, please introduce yourself and record beginning the presentation.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Justice. So, this committee is clearly aware of the loss of fiscal instability and the challenges that we faced as a result of the volatility of our oil revenue and our strong dependence on it. It's been the last several successes and great significant fiscal instability over the lifetime of this last pipeline, which is in all of the power we produced, which has been very successful for us as a state. We've been able to fund the power I produced to stay for a very long time, but the volatility associated with oil revenue has been very challenging. You know, with oil revenue, oil production down by 25% of oil once was at the peak of oil production. This has led to additional fiscal instability for our state. We've had a very good year this year, and our prices are a little bit better, but what we know is what goes up will come down again eventually. And this committee has been working on fiscal solutions, and I think it is possible to figure out a pathway to address our fiscal instability in the state of Alaska. And I think there's really nowhere that the fiscal instability has been more evident than in public education. And while House Bill 259 doesn't address the foundation for the union, it certainly has two votes to do that. Which strongly in support of. The vast majority of education that goes directly to classrooms across the state of Alaska, our inability to resolve our state's fiscal situation has been threatened. We haven't been able to keep up with the cost of delivering public education in the state of Alaska. And we know that we're now spending about $500 less per child when these dollars are the allocation funds. Adjusted for inflation, and we were in FY 08, and that's having some pretty significant impacts on the state of Alaska's ability to fund public education. In fact, we heard, I believe, Dr. Lisa Parity say we're no longer doing more or less, we're not doing less or less. And in the House Education Committee, we heard some pretty certainly examples of cost impacts in the state of Alaska, and also talked to members of all districts in the last few days and heard a few of these impacts in addition to losing educators as fighting up the bottom of our version. We heard from the Big School District that had to cut all of your career and technical education, which is the programs which are proven to improve graduation rates as well as help ensure that Alaskans are paying for the jobs of today and tomorrow. We've eliminated our pre-kindergarten program, which we know is a evidence-based program that improves educational outcomes as well as supports at-risk families. In the Anchorage School District in my home community, we've closed new schools and consolidated numerous programs. We now
hired fewer employees in any other school district than we did 15 years ago. I'm trying to figure out at a local school in which the students that are at the school had to lead a fundraising effort in order to get their security guard position funded, which was slated for elimination and emerging class sizes, where you across the bigger school district and across the state of Alaska. There was one high school in Anchorage, Alaska. I was talking to a student yesterday who was in a class with 45 other children, and I can tell you I had to do that weeks in middle school, and it was a class where not a lot of learning took place because the teacher was doing nothing but not to that classroom that I taught. We need to know instructors that they have to teach six classes every day with a high number of students. Students are not getting an education that they really need. And deliver in those kinds of scenarios. I'm like, we need to make we're looking at funding public education through the basketball thing. The folks have said, asked why, and it's like, do we do that? Well, that's for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a constitutionally required obligation to the state of Alaska Article 7, Section 1, clearly outlines obligation to provide for public schools. The second is that the public funds are a very stable source of income. And as we've seen in this community over time, in the legislature, oil and gas is a fairly volatile source of revenue, whereas the public funds is sort of a steady and growing source of revenue. And this graph here, I think, illustrates that even more clearly for everybody. This is per capita general fund revenue and budget when adjusted for inflation, and this is done by legislative finance. And you can see that over on the far right, we are beginning FY19. The parent market funding drive of the permanent fund is a bit of surplus of almost $1.3 billion. Adds the asset work eliminated dividend program, I believe that was just on the last dividend program, but this sort of illustrates if you go down to the bottom for the 50-50 split, which is what the governor's proposed, is also creates a $400 million deficit for a period of time when you can get into the future. One-third, two-thirds balances the budget and produces a very small revenue surplus even for 8 years. But the 75-25, I believe, is not sustainable. So that you have probably one of this much surplus for 8 years. I don't think we would have this much surplus if we passed the 75-25 exam, which they were making with strategic investments like the capital and deferred maintenance. DWR across the state of Alaska, which hasn't been addressed when we had border deferred maintenance. Back then, we heard about from Mr. Gleason with the Alaska Native people. We can also start investing in things like integral personal national curriculum and there's reading programs as proposed by the governor. If we had enough of a surplus to do so, there's a lot of capital funds that will come to Alaska through the federal infrastructure and project
things have to be met by a legal contribution. And so any presenting like qualifies for me is a way of essentially passing a balanced budget that allows to start making those strategic investments. So let's talk about what House Bill 259 does and how it works. House Bill 259 rewrites the dividend formula and creates a streamlined growing dividend for Alaskans. It essentially proposes that out of the 5% market value draw from the current fund that we will use, 25% would go to dividends, producing that $1,300 dividend, and that's why 24 in the 75% remaining, half would go to the general fund, and half would go to people in education, so for the foundation formula funding and people transportation, including people transportation and special for high school year, but that's very important, but cost driver for school districts. On slide 9, you can see the visual representation of the way the proposal is drafted. And you can see on the top left is the 5% of market value which then is split 25% for dividends, and the 75% for state spending. 50% would go to the general fund, and 50% would go to the foundation education funding. If the 50% of the 75% was less than given to fully fund people transportation and the foundation formula, the balance would be given to the general fund. If that amount is more than the foundation formula, then the additional funds produced would be distributed directly to school districts according to the foundation formula. So it creates really a streamlined growing funding stream for public education. On this slide here, you can see this is a predictable growing dividend for the people of Alaska. I think this is important because we have a lot of volatility in dividend over time as well. And the people of Alaska, this creates a challenge as you know. It's not just in the last few years, but even though we're getting financial choice permanent, also this historical volatility of the historic dividend formula. So, creating fiscal stability for the people of Alaska as well as for the state of Alaska makes a lot of sense to me. And on the right, you can see in that orange line, the dividend that would be produced in the 75-25 proposed in House Bill 259, which was started as a $30 dividend. And just by the way, it really is worth it's a little bit audible there after beating in FY31 by 1.16 dollars. There's a couple of other things that I want to just highlight for you. We go to the sectional analysis slide. One is the cost of the dividend as a one-time budget. You can see on the far left, if we had a statutory dividend, and all this would be about $2.7 billion in equipment cost compares to the operations of the state of Alaska and UTS spending. You can see on the far right that the $16 department identified in the far right that would total $1.5 billion. So you can see that the statutory dividend is more than the spending in general for the vast majority of state operations. The 50-50 would still be about $1.7 billion and more than we spend in corrections, the university, public safety, the judiciary, and so on. With only public education and health and social services, even in the beginning of ballpark and expenses, but you can see that public education is one of the main UGF drivers, and so I think that's very important. And what we're proposing to do in this bill is to, establish a dividend that is sustainable and affordable for the state of Alaska in the 75-25. That would cost the state of Alaska about $900 million in the first year in comparison. And it's about $100 million for us to spend on all health and social services to ensure 160,000 Alaskans for health care, for example, and is about $300 million for students in public education. And this chart here shows how House Bill 259 creates a stable and growing fund source for Alaska's schools. The first line there is a percent of market value drawn. You can see that's going to grow between $3.6 billion in fiscal year 24 and grow to about $4.6 billion in FY31. You can see below that is the statutory minimum foundation formula for public education. And the third line down is what House Bill 259 would fund for foundation formula, people
Section 1 of the bill inserts a new subsection in Article 14 that states that the fee amount appropriated under Section 6 of the bill is not sufficient to satisfy the foundation formula funding for overall education that the remaining need may be appropriated by the legislature for the general fund. Section 2 of the bill inserts a new language stating that the amount available for appropriation may not exceed the balance of the earnings reserve account. This language is necessary because the section of law hasn't been updated since the passage of the bill on the draw, but in the past it was a mathematical impossibility. Section 3 provides the statutory split of the BOM draw as follows. 25% available for distribution of permanent fund dividends, and 75% are distributed to the general fund. Not less than 50% of that 75% may go to the public education, to the public education fund, in order to be distributed directly to school districts. In Section 3, as well as in Section 4, multiple other sections of this bill, you will find language clarifying that an appropriation is required to remove funds from the earnings reserve account to the principal, and that it is not a transfer. This change was made by legislative legal in order to make the language of this bill, the current statute, constitutional and in line with the findings of the court, which is a result of public being made in 2017. Section 5 of the bill, you will find additional language clarifying that the IRA funds are to be appropriated but not transferred in the good rule section before relating to the IRA has funds. Section 6 of the bill adds a new subsection. That's the section that provides that at least half of the portion of the BOD draw distributed to the available to the general fund may go to education for state aid to school districts for the purposes of satisfying that the foundation formula. Section 7 of the bill also has language clarifying that the funds from the DOMB fund must be appropriated. Section 8 is a technical and informing change. It is simply removing language that already exists in another section of law. Section 10 of the bill includes two repealers. It's repealing sections which prohibit appropriations from the earnings reserve that exceeded funds available for appropriation. It merely moves language into sections 2 and 3 of the bill, so it's essentially a conforming change. And section 11 provides an effective date of July 1st, 2023. Okay.
No surprise that the students were performing well in my way compared to their peers are now fleeing in large pests. But that was it. Today, after years of declining funding and winters, the new Lombok accountability and the pay for the performance sort of attitude as a justification to continue short-term dangerous fears. You cannot start the system resources more and more over time, cut programs and supports for students, diminish retirement, and lower off competitive wages and benefits, and expect the same outcomes. You can't start the system and then in the very next breath blame it for failing to produce. If someone is asking themselves, what are we paying for because we're not seeing the outcomes we want, then I'd say they're asking themselves the wrong question. The right question is to ask what we've done differently that's caused the decline in outcomes and how do we fix it. We support the concept outlined in Article 259 as a novel approach to honor Alaska's constitutional commitment to public education. Hospital 259 is an innovative solution that shows we can and we must do better, and it puts Alaska's students and young people at the center of the conversation about moving forward. Thank you for bringing this proposal forward, and thank you all for your time, attention, and consideration.
I'll leave it to your question for Representative Cox. Earlier, this one's for Mr. Kumar.
Thank you. Lieutenant Kumar, you mentioned that the teachers are not in the social security system. And I'm just confused on what that happened. Is that a federal mandate, or was that a choice that was made at some point in the unpublished choice?
Yes, thank you for the question, Representative Cox. Thank you, Chair. That was a decision actually made in 1951 when the retirement for teachers was considered not enough, that they didn't feel like they also needed Social Security benefits. Of course, since then, we're now down to tier 3, tier 4. In each case, the new tier reducing the retirement benefit over time. And of course, not addressing the need for safety net of Social Security, which didn't exist as stringently before. And yes, there is a way back. We're researching that. It's fines and therefore could be held either in a school district. So if a school board authorizes the Social Security Administration to hold a vote of members in that district, they could opt back into Social Security, or that could be a statewide vote as well, which requires, as I understand it, approval of the governor. We're researching to see if there's a role for the state legislature to play in that. I don't have a definitive answer right now as to what that would be and some of the other details of the process. But there is a way back in, and we're interested in pursuing that as well.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know whether it is worth pursuing that, but I guess we can. It is not to ask it. Yeah. Yeah. We have a question for Mr. Kumar. I don't see any silver button yet. We thank you, Mr. Kumar. We're not going to go to Dr. Gurney.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you so much. This is one of those of the representatives of Mrs. Carol's journey and the executive director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. These are things that in 1973, the same concerns umbrella was an Alaska Senior Education Leadership Organization, including all superintendents, elementary and secondary school principals, Alaska Association of School Leadership, and all other remaining school administrators across Alaska. So really, one of the things you invited me to speak in support of House Bill 259 today, and I'd just like to thank Representative Sutton and Sutton originally in this bill for consideration. Most of you have seen our different statements, and know that in our organization, members, policy decisions. And while students' communities always have their own priority, of all, school districts are generally one of the large businesses. And you, as legislators and appropriators, help us balance our budget and be good, strong financial managers. And stable funding allows for us to do that, as well as allows for us to recruit and maintain our quality educators, which is a new matter address. Districts know the dollar amount that you receive in funding. They can plan their budgets for the upcoming fiscal year with more certainty. And right now, what we have, inflation over 7%, I think our starting is addressed with really year high for inflation and arrested. And school district are doing that at every level. Our budget has been processed, fuel and utility and insurance. Continue to write it. I have no control on our crime. So district leaders don't have to make their decisions about their budgets without knowing what they are paying for the state. You don't want to manage your own personal life that way. You don't want businesses to manage their life that way. And you shouldn't want school districts to manage that way. This bill provides stability for our funding. Thank you.
see any questions, we appreciate your time. But how you doing? You'll skip over the third question for both of you, of
course.
Thank you for the opportunity. I agree with you that no one wants to see killing, we don't want to see stability. But we have seen over the years that in most areas, in the private sector, personal, or business, stability isn't there. If you were IBM, you always wanted to focus on mainframe computers. If you were Kodak, you wanted to focus on instead of digital cameras. So, although that stability is very good, but what then is important in education? There are a number of things that have changed to provide the service of education, internet building, being on computers, etc. What is the incentive to consider new ideas if the focus is on guaranteed funding the way we're doing it now?
Good afternoon. And I, for the record, what I think is, well, I'm here as an executive director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. That has been an opportunity this afternoon to testify today on how solutions are denied. Thank you, Representative Stockholz, for introducing this unique opportunity for funding both education and the growing fund at hand. The Association of Alaska School Boards is in support of House Bill 259. ASB's Gallery Assembly has six bipartisan resolutions supporting elements of this legislation. These include Early Statement Number 7, Education Programs and Funding as a Top Priority, Resolution 2.1, Sustaining Reliable and Adequate State Fiscal and Educational Funding Plan for Alaska Students through a non-volatile funding source, Resolution 2.2, Urging Early Adequate, Equitable, and Predictable Funding in Public Education, Resolution 2.14, that talks about people transportation, 2.23, Funding for Schools by Establishing a Base Student Allocation in Advance, and finally, Resolution 2.5, Inflation Proof Base Student Allocation Investments. Those resolutions are included with my submitted testimony. The proposed language in House Bill 259 would create a statutory framework for the legislature to use to fund both the public funding and the community of education. This still maintains the authority of the legislature to appropriate funds annually, but not set aside education funding from the direct competition with all other appropriations, and thus fulfilling your responsibility in Article 7, Section 1 of Alaska's Constitution. The legislation could then concentrate on the remainder of public services that are required to provide for Alaska citizens and make our state such a wonderful place to live and raise our families. House Bill 259 directly addresses several recommendations of the legislative fiscal working group. Creating a workable and usable solution to funding the PFD will remove the ongoing debate, but have to allow the legislature to focus on those important public policies that affect Alaskans. In turn, House Bill 259 would then provide a more stable and predictable funding source for education, allowing districts to concentrate on educational innovation to improve student outcomes, which is our key plan. Rather than continually reducing programs due to the erosion of buying power of a flat funded based in allocation, locally elected school boards have been delegated the authority through statute to implement the system of public education required by the Alaska Constitution. School board members are tasked with governing their districts and allocating funds to execute an educational plan for all students attending their public schools. It's a highly complex task. Alaska school boards have no capacity authority. They therefore must rely solely on revenue from the state, federal government, and an organizing base that leads to a local minimum contribution to funding education. Each year, school board members and education advocates appeal for education funding to meet the needs of providing an excellent education for every student every day. House Bill 259 would provide the means to help satisfy that appeal. I want to recognize that the legislature has upheld its constitutional responsibility to fund the public school system every year. However, that funding through the rate of student allocation has not seen an increase from the current $5,930 since FY17. 6 years with no increase seems disingenuous to expect constant improvement in instruction, graduation rates, literacy proficiency, and improved test scores, just to name a few indicators. House Bill 259 provides an opportunity for potential future increases to educational funding and the permanent fund grows and the 50% provided volume grows. In many of costs, including buildings, supplies, transportation, fuel, salaries, maintenance, freight, food, instructional materials, and other services and materials for operating the school system, have all increased significantly since FY17. Among the costs, the ratio of pay exceed well over 7%. The only thing that has increased is the pace of the allocation. During the ASB school this past weekend. School board members from across the state discussed the tremendous strain their budget faced with ever-increasing costs. Many of my school board members may have visited neurologists and told you those stories. A great note on the incredible cost of fuel, especially for those districts that have schools that are located away from the road system. We heard people justify that fuel prices can range anywhere from $7 to well over $10 per gallon or more. This means the cost of heating buildings, transporting goods, or even students significantly impacts the amount of money that can be available to hire and retain the very people that we need with our teachers and other support personnel to do the job that must be done. As an example, during discussions that I had yesterday, one superintendent of a remote rural district noted that in general, for every 100 gallons of materials they purchase, they must allocate an additional $200 in freight charges. The finance division of the annual appropriations for education funding as part of a state general fund budget and potential executive vetoes continue to create uncertainty and make it difficult to sustain maintenance of effort in an effective and efficient manner. My colleagues prior to me referenced that. Hiring and boards and superintendents must make hard choices that result in a reduction of staff and elimination of programs and services, which can negatively impact student achievement. House Bill 259 provides a substantive opportunity for the legislature to move forward with a statute that acknowledges the importance and necessity of providing predictable, sustainable, and more adequate funding for education. As I stated previously, locally elected school boards have been delegated the authority to implement the system of public education on behalf of the state of high school. In order to do that, they rely on state, local, and federal governments for revenue. Locally elected boards implement the local control model that has served the high school well and continues to do so, but it depends on their support. As they struggle to pay for your support, the House Bill 259 is a way of further supporting Alaska's public school system, and more importantly, Alaska's future and the education of its young people. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Garrison. Thank you for your testimony on behalf of your AESD. So, no other questions to Mr. Garrison. That's going to wrap up our first hearing on 259. And just a couple of housekeeping points. I just want to thank Recording Secretary Sophia Penny, Fellow Moderator Doug Bridges. I'd like to remind members that our last meeting is Thursday, 7 p.m. at 11:30 here in Room 106. Your presence.